The Shmooze this evening is sponsored by Noah Fried in honor of a tremendous mazel tov, his passing the bar. Very nice. May you go mechayel lechayel, a tremendous amount of atzlacha. Shlomo Melech was sitting as a judge, and two women appear in front of him, each one claiming a very interesting event. The first woman claims that the other woman was sleeping at night. That other woman rolled over, smothered her baby. Then that woman saw that a baby died, took the dead baby, swapped it for the live baby. And in fact, this woman standing in front of Shlomo HaMelech says that my baby is the live baby, and she exchanged it with the dead baby. The other woman says it never happened. It was the woman who's claiming is lying, no such thing happened, really it's her baby that died, and this event is what Shlomo HaMelech is going to decide. Now the pasuk is very clear, v'tedaber na lifnei HaMelech. They didn't say their claims once, they said them repeatedly. Repeatedly, each woman got a chance to say her claim, to tell over the details of the story, to tell it over not once, not twice, minimum of three times, maybe even more, detail by detail, letter by letter. After they were each finished their side of the story, Vayomer HaMelech, the king said, Zos Someres, this one says, Zebni Achaya Bnei Sameis, this one says that it is my child that lives and her child that's dead, Vizos Someres, this other woman says, no, the opposite, Ki Bnei Chameis, it's your child that died, Bnei Achaya, and my child that lived. Now the Rishonim, as well as the Gemara, are troubled by one particular point in this case. And that is, why did Shlomo HaMelech repeat the claims of these women? They said the claim, they said it a second time, they said it a third time. There was no reason for Shlomo HaMelech to repeat their claims. This woman says this, this woman says that. Says the Radak on the Pasuk, the Radak says, Amar Rabbeinu, from here the Chachamim learn, Shesarach Adayin Lishnos Tainos Bali Adin. A judge must repeat over the claims of the claimants, so that the litigants should hear, that the judge understood their claims, and on their claims he is reaching his verdict. The reason why Shlomo HaMelech repeated these claims is the same reason that judges today as well repeat, so that each of the litigants should know that their claims were heard, and it's on their claims that the judge is actually bringing his verdict. Therefore Shlomo HaMelech repeated it. And in fact, in Shulchan Aruch and Chosh Mishpat, this is the halacha, that the judge must repeat each claimant's claim, he must repeat it, and on it he paskins the halacha. Now, if you think about that, there is a rather obvious question, I think, that surfaces about this particular halacha in this case. And that is, what is the reason why the judge repeats it? The reason is because there's a truism in the world that there are three sides to every story. There is my side, your side, and the truth. Meaning whenever a situation comes to court, there's Reuven's claim, there's Shimon's claim, and invariably it's somewhere in the middle, maybe more to one side, more than the other, but it's very, very rare that it's black or white. The reason why the judge says over the claims is to make sure that A, he understands what each one is claiming. It's a complex situation. There are many details to what happened. There are various scenarios involved. I want to make sure that I know exactly what Reuven, your claim is. Shimon, I want to make sure I know exactly what your claim is. By the judge repeating it, he makes it known his understanding. If he didn't understand it properly, Reuven is going to say, no, sir, your honor, that's not my claim. If Shimon feels that his position was not properly heard, he'll correct. So the judge will, in fact, know exactly the claims. Additionally, not only will the judge know the claims, each of the litigants will know that they've been heard. Each litigant will know that his claim was heard properly, and it's on that claim that he's being judged, so everyone will know that justice has been served. And in a normal Beis Din case, that halacha makes sense. However, in this case, that makes no sense. Why? Because this was not a complex case. There was no details, there was no great mystery, there was an absolute bald-faced lie. One of these women invented a total fabrication. either the first woman's child died and the second one didn't, or the second woman's child. There's no mystery. There's no maybe, ifs, ands, or buts. One of these women is telling an absolute sheker. The other one isn't. It's a very clear-cut case. There's no great mystery. There's nothing for the dayan to make sure that everybody's claims are heard. It's black and white. It's simple. There's no reason for Shlomo Melech to repeat this over here. And if you're not hearing this question yet, let me focus on this story a little bit more. When we dig down into the details of the story a bit more, I think we'll see this question is even more profound. And to do that, I'd like to ask one simple question. One woman's response makes sense. The other one doesn't. The woman who says, "Let the child live," makes sense. Remember what happened over here is as follows. Each woman claims the other woman's child has been killed. What does Shlomo do? Shlomo, after repeating the claim, says, "Bring me a sword." And he asks for a very, very sharp sword. One of the guardsmen of the court brings in a sword. He tells the guardsman, "Now take the baby, put the baby down, cut the baby in half." At which point, one of the women screams, "No, no, 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 please, 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 let her have the baby. Rather, the baby should live, but her have the baby." The other woman says, "No, cut it. I'll take half, you take half." Now, if you think about that story, there are two major problems with that story. Number one, why in the world would the second woman say, "Yes, cut it in half"?
Yeah.
Isn't that ridiculous? She clearly, if she stole the baby, she stole it because she wanted the baby. What good is it cutting the baby in half? Clearly she wanted the baby, whether it's her baby or a stolen baby that she stole. Clearly she wanted it. What does she gain by having it cut in half? But more than that, why in the world does Shlomo Melech assume that either woman would say anything other than, "Of course don't kill the baby. Of course I want the baby alive"? Why would Shlomo Melech ever entertain the possibility that either woman would say anything but, "If you let her have it, I don't want the baby to die"? And I think when we study what's actually going on, I think we'll get a much better understanding. And to study this, we have to begin at the very beginning of the parak. Begivon nir Hashem el Shlomo. When Shlomo Melech first became king, Hashem appeared to Shlomo and said as follows, Sha'al ma'etin lach, Shlomo, ask what you will. Hashem appeared to Shlomo Melech and told him, "Whatever you ask for will be granted to you. What do you wish for?" At which point Shlomo in that dream said, "I wish for one thing. Teni lev shamaya lishpot, give me a heart that knows to judge. Lahavim bein tov l'ra, to understand the distinction between good and bad." Shlomo Melech asked for one thing, wisdom. The king was the head of the judiciary process. In the Jewish system, the king is responsible for creating the law, being responsible to judge the law. He's the head of the legal system. The king is the shofet, he's the judge. Shlomo Melech said to Hashem, "Give me the wisdom to judge appropriately." Hashem said, "Because that's what you asked for, you're going to be granted that, plus wealth, plus length of days. You'll be granted everything," because apparently Shlomo Melech found favor in Hashem's eyes with that request. And after that dream, Vayikatz Shlomo v'nei chalom, Shlomo awoken and it was a dream. Says Rashi, when he was asleep, he didn't realize it was a dream. It was so vivid. Hashem's appearance to him was so palpable that only when he awoke did he recognize that it was a dream. How did he recognize it was a dream? Because as soon as he opened his eyes, he heard the birds chirping and he understood what they were saying. Shlomo Melech was granted phenomenal wisdom. He understood the various dibur, the speech of all the animals. He had wisdom, say the Rishonim, he had wisdom that surpassed Moshe Rabbeinu. He was granted phenomenal wisdom, arguably the wisest of all men, and he began at his monarchy with that amazing state of clarity. The very first case that he's asked to judge, that very next day, is this case. Into the court come these two women, and Shlomo Melech perceives immediately that not just one of these women are lying, he knows exactly who it is that's lying, and he knows precisely her motivation. You see, the Malbim explains, if you pay very careful attention to the claims, there's something unusual. One woman said, "It is my child that lived and your child that died." The response was, "No, no, 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 no. Your child died, my child lived." Three times the second woman said those words, that "your child died, mine lives," says the Malbim. what's close to a person's heart, what's dear to them, they ask for first. What Shlomo Melech understood was this other woman wasn't concerned that it was her child that lived, she was concerned that it's your child that died. What Shlomo Melech understood was that the second woman was motivated by one single fact, and that was called jealousy. She saw that the other woman's baby was alive and her baby died. It didn't concern her that a baby was dead. It didn't concern her that the other child was alive. It concerned her that her mate, her person that she roomed with, was now ahead of her in some way. She was jealous. She was sickened by that jealousy. And she said the words, "No, no, 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 it's your child that died." She couldn't stand to have the other woman ahead of her. And that was the motivation that Shlomo perceived very, very quickly in what was going on. And what that means in plain simple language is Shlomo Melech knew exactly who was innocent and who was guilty. Shlomo Melech knew exactly the motivation. But more than that, there was no complication in the case. Each of the women knew 100% whether they were telling the truth or not. Shlomo Melech knew 100% whether they were telling the truth or not. What Shlomo Melech did was devise a mechanism to prove to the world that one of these women is a liar, motivated strictly by jealousy, because her reaction is going to be, "No, better let the baby die than anyone else have it," because the motivation was jealousy. If that's true, then there's no reason for Shlomo to repeat the tainus. You see, the litigants know what's happening. Shlomo knows what's happening. Normally, the judge repeats the claim so the litigants know they've made their case well, or so that the judge knows the case well. None of those reasons apply. The question is, why did Shlomo Melech do this in this case? What are we being taught by this? And I think that even though this question may sound subtle, I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn specifically from the answer. And to answer this, I'd like to take a little bit of a step away. I remember as a boy, I grew up, I guess like most boys, basketball at a certain age in my life was a very big deal. And I remember at that age in my life, not just basketball, but playing basketball well was a real big deal. And I remember visualizing making it onto a high school team, making it onto a college team, one day playing in the NBA. And you have to recognize the fact that obviously by race and by certain other criteria, I might not be cut out to play in the NBA, but it didn't matter. In my mind, I saw it. I was playing JV. I was playing varsity. In my mind, I was in the pros and I was right there on the court shooting with the best of them. I was there. But here's the point. It was so real, so visual, so palpable. I could feel it. I could sense it. I could touch it. And to a child, that ability to imagine, the ability to see himself in a fantasy world is very, very real, very, very powerful. You should know for the record that that's not something that's relegated only to children and not something that's limited to children. We all visualize and we all can actually benefit from some element of imagination. I'll share with you an interesting study. A psychologist, Alan Richardson, did the following study. He took three groups of college students and gave them, put them all on a basketball court and asked them to shoot hoops. And each one got graded by how many shots on average he would make. Graded them, set them, the three groups apart, and gave each group the following assignment. For the next month, they were to practice for 30 minutes. The first group was to go to the gym for 30 minutes, practice shooting, working on their shot, improving their game. The second group, the control group, was to do nothing, not to play ball, not to do anything for the next month other than just regular college life. And the third group was given a very different exercise. For a half hour a day, they were to go to the dorm, sit in their dorm room, close their eyes, and imagine that they're on the court shooting. Imagine that they're on the foul line taking shots. Imagine that they're moving around the court. For a half hour a day, they were to visualize themselves taking shots. After the month, he brought the three groups back, and this is what he found. The group that hadn't practiced at all, obviously, were shooting at the same percentage rate as they had a month ago. They hadn't improved. The group that had been on the court practicing every day for a half hour had shown a 25% improvement in the amount of shots that they were now hitting. Very substantial improvement. Interestingly enough, the group that went to their dorm room, didn't touch a basketball, but closed their eyes and imagined they were shooting, improved 24%. almost as much as a group that had been on the court shooting. And what he proved with this little experiment was that visualization, imagining, seeing it, isn't just a fantasy world of the child, but can have very real physiological effects, can have very real teaching effects on the muscular systems, on the various things that go into things, and can make a real difference. For the record, nothing to do with this schmooze, it is a very important technique to use. If you have a difficult meeting coming up and you close your eyes and visualize success, you're more likely to succeed. If you visualize yourself walking into that meeting confident and creating the type of environment that you need to succeed, it's more likely that you will respond. Your physiological systems will respond. Your mental state will respond. You'll be much more primed and ready. And visualization is something that many, many athletes use. Many, many athletes swear by. Their success is largely due to their visualizing their success. However, I think this concept has a very real application to our lives as well. When a person visualizes things, what happens is you're there. Your blood rate goes up, your heart rate increases, your blood pressure increases. If you imagine that you're walking down a dark alley and someone jumps you, you can feel your heart rate increase. If you read a novel and there's a scary part of the book, you're nervous. If you're in a theater and you're watching a play, what's going on the stage affects you, even though just in the world of imagination, you're affected, it changes you. And I believe that Shlomo Melech was much aware of that following criteria. You see, this woman, though she be a liar, was getting up to lie in court. She was saying the words, "It's your child that died and mine that lived." And Shlomo Melech knew that a woman cannot lie in court, say it three times, without on some level visualizing that and on some level believing it. Shlomo Melech was afraid that on some level this woman would have convinced herself that what she's saying is true. She would have believed it, even though she knows that she suffocated a child the night before. She would have visualized it in her mind. No, it's the opposite. That woman's child died. It's mine that lived. It's hers that died. Because she said the word, she would have visualized it. Because she visualized it, she would have accepted it as true. And had the judge said the words, "You're a liar, you're guilty," she would have said he didn't hear the story right. He judged it wrong. Had he heard the right story, he never would have said it. She would have walked out of court in her mind being innocent, the other woman being guilty. What did Shlomo Melech do? He did something very, very interesting. He showed her that he understood. Not just that he heard her claim. He understood what she was saying and he validated it. "Madam, what you're saying that happened is X, Y, and Z." By repeating her words, he demonstrated he heard it, understood it, validated that story. Now she was open to accept the truth. And Shlomo Melech, with his wisdom, understood that had she not been validated, had she not been heard, she might well have rejected the psak, even though it was clear to her, clear to the king. She would have rejected it. Only when she was understood, only when she was validated, could she accept that which he said. And my friends, this concept, I believe, has very, very real application to our life. This concept of a need to be understood, a need to be validated, is a very, very real concept that has some major implications. Every once in a while, I mention secular books that I highly recommend. There's a secular book that I recommend very highly. It's a quick read. It won't take you very long. It's called How to Argue and Win. Now, the reason why it won't take you very long is because there are no pages in the book. Because you cannot argue and win. It just doesn't work. You see, if you argue, you'll never, ever convince your opponent that you're right. You can argue, but that's all you're going to do. You will never, ever, ever, ever argue and win. Jerry Spence, Kvodo Yomo B'Makomo, who wrote the book called How to Argue and Win, was referring to something else. Not my arguing against you and winning your goodwill, not my convincing you, but arguing a position so that other people who are non-objective, not involved in the case, can hear. That can happen. I could present a position so that people who are not no gaya badava, who have no vested interest, can hear. But the minute two human beings engage in argument, there is no victory. because no one understands the process of arguing will shut down my opponent's ability to hear. My arguments can be brilliant. My logic can be infallible. My opponent will not hear a word that I say. And you ever notice that the more you argue, the less the guy listens? And the more you argue, the less he hears? And when you study the human, what you quickly understand is that if criticism is a very, very dangerous activity that one should not engage in, we mentioned that in last week's Shmooze, there is a junior cousin of criticism called argument. What happens when I argue against you is there becomes a battle. There becomes a locking of horns. It's you against me, me against you, and you will not budge. The more I argue, the more you argue against me. The more I argue stronger, the more you argue back. And there is no way to argue and win. And with that being mentioned, I'd like to share with you a very, very important part of human relations. When we get into conflicts, we only get into conflicts with reasonable people. We don't really have much to do with presidents of Iran who want us dead. We don't regularly meet with Palestinian leaders who just dream about Jewish blood being spilled. The people that we get into conflicts with on a regular basis are reasonable, like-minded people. People much like you and I, people who are not vindictive, people who are not out to get us. Yet on a regular basis, it seems that we get into conflicts, whether it be with a boss, whether it be with a coworker, whether it be with a husband or wife. There's a constant state of conflicts that people get in, some people more often, some people less often. But I'd like to share with you what I consider the three steps to conflict resolution. And when you hear these three steps, I think the issue will become much, much more clear. Number one. No conflict that you and I get into is about the issue. You ever notice a husband and wife can discuss many, many issues? Religion, what neighborhood to live in, even what school to send the kids to. Big deal issues. They have no problem. You feel, I feel, you feel, I feel. But then when it comes to very interesting things like what color the garbage can should be, what do you mean what color? Black, white, red? No, okay. Can you agree? Whether we should paint the kitchen blue. But if you pay attention to the fights that most couples have, it's not about the big deal issues. It's not about the real issues of life. It's about picayune little things. And you know why that is? The reason for that is really quite simple. There is no conflict that happens over the issue. The conflict is over the ego. You see, it's not whether the garbage can should be green or red, whether the paint should be blue or white. It's whether I was given the due respect or I was dissed, whether I feel I was listened to or I feel that I was ignored. My friends, I'd like to share with you, that which your children do on a regular basis, they ignore people. You know, little children get angry at somebody, I'm ignoring you. As a child, it's okay. One of the most grave insults you could ever do to another human being is to ignore them. Because what you're doing is you're being mavatal them. You're saying they're non-existent. It's not just that you're not important, you're so insignificant that I don't even deem it necessary to respond to you. That arguably is the greatest insult in the world. And would you like to know what happens when you argue? You may not recognize it, but what you're doing is completely, utterly ignoring the person. She said X, Y, and Z, and you don't even give her the courtesy of response. Immediately, you're blurting back to what you were saying. She knows it. You knew it. You're not answering her. You're not addressing her. You're arguing. And what you're doing in very real terms is you're ignoring the person. And if you don't hear that so well, watch what happens on the other side of it. The minute you're able to open your ears and listen, if you quiet your response down and just listen, let me hear, what are you saying? Explain it to me again. You ever notice the person has a very different attitude? The conflict is never about the issue. It's always about the ego. It's always about the I. That's rule number one for conflict resolution. Rule number two, I think, is also obvious, but requires being spoken out. No conflict, no fight will ever end until one party concedes. It only stops when one party says, I give in, and that's when it ends. But if both parties hold their grounds, that fight, which began on Tuesday night, will continue Wednesday night, Thursday night. It will continue for weeks, months, until one party gives in. And that's pretty obvious, right? But here's the difficult part. And this is where many marriages get into trouble. When the husband, in his own mind, says, I'll give in as soon as she concedes. As soon as she says the words, I'm right, then I'll give in. And the wife says, as soon as he says the words, I was right, I'll give in. And both parties lock horns, and they're fighting about this major issue called what color the garbage can should be. And they're fighting for days, and they're fighting a bitter battle. And if you think I'm joking, I'm not inventing this. I'm not joking. I'm not creating stories. In the real world, most marital conflict are not about big deal issues. They're about very, very petty, small issues. Because the issue is not the point. It's the ego, it's the I, it's a denial of the person, it's the inability to recognize the other person. And we come to the third point. And this is the most difficult point. And that is, no matter how you try, no matter how you wish it to be, you cannot force the other party to concede. You cannot say to your wife, you know what, this is a stupid fight, so you better give in right now. And if you don't, X, Y, and Z. If you try that tactic, you'll find a very interesting result, most likely ending in either bigger fight or a get. But if you think that you can end the fight by forcing the other party to concede, by forcing the other party to give in, forget about it, it never worked. The only way in the world that you could ever end the fight is by you conceding, by you giving in. If it's you, if it's your wife, if it's you, if it's your partner, if it's you, if it's your employee, you can't control him or her. You can control you. And if you'd like to end conflict in your life, understanding these three principles, I think, is huge in terms of understanding this. Let me share with you on a practical level exactly what I mean. Sally and Bob, we're going to make them from, we'll call them Yaakov and Sarah, are in a fight. And they're screaming and yelling, ranting and raving. There's a very simple solution that either one can solve the problem with if they do it exactly in this way. If Reuven walks over to his wife and says as follows, I hear what you are saying. You're saying this. And I agree that you have a valid point. He's already done 50% of his job. You see, let's assume for a minute that she's screaming at him, we're always late. Why is it every time we come to you, to your parents, we're always late, I'm embarrassed, and we're late again, and you've done it, and you've blown it. And in his mind, he knows clearly that A, she's the one who's late, not him, and B, it's very rare that they're late. If he is a wise husband, he will say these words, I hear what's bothering you. You're very embarrassed by the fact that we're late. And I agree with you, you're right. It is 10 after 7, and we're supposed to be there at 7. But tell me, is that really what's troubling you? Is that really the issue? Now, sometimes it will be the issue. Oftentimes it may not be. Oftentimes it may be the fact that she feels she's competing with her sister-in-law, and her sister-in-law always dresses nicer, her sister-in-law always has a better shaitel and looks better, and she feels inferior, in which case her husband will find out that it's nothing to do with him, nothing to do with his being late, but only because he took down the walls of conflict. Does he find that out? But sometimes, in fact, he'll find out that it is the fact that he's late. But if he says these words, I hear what's bothering you. And I hear that you're really concerned that we're late. And I agree with you. It is 10 minutes after 7. We are late. He will have gone a huge step forward. But it's the next two steps that really makes the difference. When she says, yes, that really is what bothers me, if he says these words, I understand that it troubles you. I understand that it really does bother you. I feel badly. It happens to be I feel that we're not really often that late. I feel we're usually on time. That, my friends, is a formula for solving most conflicts. You see, if you acknowledge the other person's right to the feeling, if you say back what they said, if you say the words, I agree, and every single time there's something to agree on, you then understand it, you then have every right as a person to say back the words, but I feel But you see, what you've done is you've taken away the hostility. You've taken it from an ego conflict to the issue at hand. The issue at hand is, should we send our child to this yeshiva, that yeshiva? Should we paint the room blue or green? Should we do this or that? You've taken it off the ego. But if you don't do that, you're going to end up in a very real fix, because you're going to end up conflict after conflict after conflict. Now, my friends, I want you to know, I learned this lesson, I'm sorry to say, the hard way. I spent the first 10 years of my marriage making a radical blunder. Baruch Hashem, I married very well. And Baruch Hashem, my wife forgave me for this blunder. But it took me 10 years to recognize the stupidity of my ways. You see, I was a high school Rebbe. And as a high school Rebbe, part of your job is to teach. The other job is to be meyayitz, to give the guys advice about their issues, or to be life, or to be whatever. So guys would come to me on a regular basis with questions, and I thought I did a decent job of advising, you should do this, you should do that, and the guys walked away happy, and things were going well. But every time my wife came to me asking my sage advice, my advice somehow just didn't work. She would ask me for my opinion about this, that, or the other thing, and I would offer her my wise advice, and she was never satisfied. And it took me 10 years to recognize she was not looking for my opinion. She was not looking for my wise sage advice. She was looking for a husband to listen, to hear, to say, "Ah, I must have been rough. I feel bad. Oh, I'm very sorry." And to keep your opinion to yourself. Muzzle your mouth and provide what you're being asked for, which is support, which is empathy, which is maybe basic and self-explanatory to everyone here, but took me 10 long years to recognize. And folks, it's hard to this day, because many times to this day, my wife comes to me with a problem or an issue, and I bite my tongue and I say, "Oh, that must be terrible. Right? There is, I don't know. But what do you think we should do? I don't know. But don't you think there's anything we could? I don't know. A big problem. I've done tshuva. I don't offer, solicited or unsolicited, I don't offer advice. And I found it does me a lot more good. And my friends, even though doesn't that sound immature, doesn't sound babyish, but that's the reality. Every human being has needs. We have needs for companionship, we have needs to be recognized, and we have a need to be understood and heard. When you listen to a person, you're validating them. When you listen to a person, you're giving them the greatest honor that you could give to a human being. You're saying you are important. Your feelings are important. What goes on in your existence is significant. When you argue, what you're doing is you're doing the opposite of all of that. You're obliterating the importance of the person. You're telling them they're butthole, they're nothing. And every time you get into an argument with another human being, what you're doing is you're giving them a tremendous, tremendous punch. Almost as bad as criticism. If we don't criticize because it doesn't do any good, not listening does the same. And if you could train yourself to just listen and listen and hear the other person, you're doing them a tremendous service, and you're doing yourself a tremendous service. However, you may note that it's not so easy to do. Especially if it's your boss, if it's your brother, if it's your sister, if it's your wife. And you may note that when you get into one of those conflicts, you may understand the three steps. I have to listen, I have to stay back, I agree, and all I have to do is concede and it'll end it. But you may find it very hard to do. And I'd like to share with you the words of the Chovos HaVovos, because they're very, very powerful. The next time your wife says to you the litany, "You're late, you're sloppy, you're responsible, you're selfish, you're scatterbrained," or whatever it is that she'll say. And folks, if you're a human being, you've got some of them. Because every one of us human beings have faults. If we didn't, we'd be Malachi Asharis, we would not have been put on the planet. And when your wife or your boss or your co-worker or someone begins on the litany and has tainas against you, whether it's criticism or just simple complaints, remember the words of the Chovos HaVovos. He says as follows, "Kol ha-shekru mitov ad ra," anything that happens to a person from the good to the bad, "siba she-tov lo me'is Hashem Yisbarach," comes from Hashem. And therefore, when a person insults you, says the Chovos HaVovos, what you have to do is, you have to thank Hashem, "asher gila lo ma'at meharbe," who revealed a little bit from much, "liyasro lo chicho," to set you on the right track. Would you like to know who's saying those words? It's not your wife, it's not your coworker, it's not your boss, that's God talking. You know who's telling you that you're late or you're irresponsible? or your scatterbrain, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the creator of the heavens and earth, and that is a shliach that you're listening to. You may feel slighted, who asked you to be the shliach, but the bottom line is those words are being directed to you by God. And my friends, I'm willing to bet you, if it's a wife, there's a lot of validity to those words. And there's a lot of truth. Whether 100% true, 80%, or even 10%, there's much to be learned. And when you think about this long and hard, it becomes a lot easier to say these words. I understand what you're saying. It bothers you when I leave my socks on the floor. And I agree. It is irresponsible for a 30-year-old man who has two children to do that. And that ends most of the fight. Because then you can simply say the words, I'm sorry. Either I won't do it again and mean it. Or if it's an issue that really you feel is unjust, you can express yourself. I agree with you that X, however I feel, and you have every right to express yourself, but you see you've eliminated it from the ego conflict back to the issue, and now you're at a stage when you're able to resolve the conflict, you're able to work again with the person. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from Shlomo Melech. Shlomo Melech saw these two women, and he recognized it was a tremendous problem. This woman is speaking in court. It's impossible that she says these words and on some level doesn't believe it. Therefore, Shlomo Melech repeated, ma'am, what you're saying is, because he was telling this woman, A, I heard you. B, I understand. C, I'm validating your statement. You're not to be obliterated. You're not to be ignored. You made a statement. It's been recorded by the court. It's on record. Once the woman was validated, then she could come to the truth. Then she could admit it. And then when Shlomo Melech said the words, it's the other woman's, she could accept it. Had that not been there, the woman would have lived in a world of delusion, lived in a world of, it's really my child, the judge didn't hear the story right, he paskined incorrectly, and he would have gone the way of every judge who gets cursed before him and after him. But Shlomo Melech had tremendous wisdom. He understood the nature of the person. We human beings are very, very creative in our minds. As little children, we visualize all kinds of things, whether it be basketball stars, being billionaires, or being movie stars. That same power of visualization exists when we're adults. You could use it for the good, you could use it for your success, but also recognize the fact that we are in some level delusional. When you criticize me for something that I know that I'm 100% wrong in, it's difficult for me to admit that. It's difficult for me to see that. It's difficult for me to feel it in my heart. And once I feel you attacking me, whether it be directly criticizing or arguing, I will resist that. I'll build up the visualization to be the opposite. I will fight you. And if you'd ever like to argue and win, quit. It never, ever works. The minute you oppose another human being directly, the human being shuts down. They're not receptive, they're not listening, they're not hearing. Everything you say falls on deaf ears, and the proof is just watch. The more you argue, the less they hear. The more you argue, the less they hear. In fact, the only way to really convince a man of the opposite of what you're trying to convince him is to keep arguing, because the more you argue, the more he becomes convinced of the exact opposite, because his ego is in the fight. You could discuss politics, you could discuss religion, you could discuss the orbit of Mars. However, once you put the ego in it, it's all over. And once you understand that, you understand the key to conflict resolution. The key to resolving any conflict is to understand it's never the issue, it's always the ego. To understand that no fight ever ends until one party concedes, and then to understand that I can't force my opponent to concede. I can only work on myself. Once you understand that, you can stop any conflict that you're involved in. Because you could stop any conflict by remembering well the words of the Chovos Levavos. Likely there's a lot of truth in these words. Likely there's a lot of validity in these words. And if it's your wife who's saying it to you, I guarantee there's a lot of validity. And the words you have to say is, I hear what you are saying and I agree. I don't agree totally. I don't agree absolutely. But there's some kernel of truth in what she's saying. You agree to it. You explain to her you understand. And then you can go on to say your point. Because now you've moved from the world of the ego into the world of what you're discussing, which is the issue involved. And then you can begin living in peace again. I'd like to close with one last observation that I think is probably the greatest in this whole observations. And that is the point that Rashi says. See, Rashi says, at the very end of the verdict, Shlomo Melech says, bring the sword. They bring the sword. Shlomo says, bring the baby. Cut the baby in half. One woman says, no, give it to her. The other woman says, yes, cut the baby. Shlomo Melech says the words, she's the mother. The one that had rachamim is the mother. Says Rashi, it actually wasn't Shlomo Melech said the words. He, Imo, it is its mother, was a baskol. A verdict came out from heaven. HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself said the words, he, Imo, this one is the mother. Because Hashem wanted it to be known that Shlomo's wisdom surpasses all. Shlomo judged appropriately and properly. He, Imo. Now my friends, let's understand that. In the face of that baskol, even with the heavenly verdict coming out, this woman may have well held on to her disbelief and held on to her position had she not been heard. Had Shlomo HaMelech not said the words, she said this, had he not given her validation, had he not given her credit, she would have gone to her grave despite a baskol saying that she's a liar, despite a heavenly voice proclaiming that she's guilty. She would have lived in a delusional world because, my friends, the human being is a very curious species. And the most important thing to remember is that you and I are human beings as well. A human being has the ability to create castles in the sky, believe them, live in them. And in that state of delusion, we're very, very secure. Nothing shakes us from that. And when you understand that, you understand how delicate the human person is, how delicate the human ego is, how careful you have to be when you work with another human being. And understanding that also allows you to understand the power of validating, the power of giving the proper attention to another person. May Hashem grant us wisdom and understanding to put this in practice. Please join us.